Good afternoon. Welcome to all of you here and those of you joining us virtually. It's great to be here. This is really a beautiful venue. Our calling is an exercise in moral courage. What we're developing now in this lifetime is moral authority. The moral authority is the authority you have when people perceive that there's an alignment between what we say and what we do, what we say, what we believe, and how we behave. It's an incredibly powerful force, and we build it by the example that we set. Those who rule with Christ will do so with the power of the moral authority that they have built in this lifetime, the authority that comes from living the life we've been called to in spite of the pressures to do otherwise. The kind of authority that says, I get it, I know what you're going through, because I've done it. You can do it too. Nothing persuades or encourages like the power of a good example. For an appreciation of the power of moral authority, let's take a look at the story of Nehemiah. I'll briefly review the story up to chapter 5. It's about 445 BC. Pericles is leading the Athenian Golden Age and dealing with the Spartans. The construction of the Parthenon is underway, and Socrates is 24 years old. The Persians are the dominant world power and would remain so for another 115 years until a Greek, a Macedonian, if you will, Alexander, would absorb their empire into his. But for now, Nehemiah is in exile in Susa, which is in present-day Iran, just north of the Persian Gulf. It was a capital and the winter home of the Persian kings. Nehemiah had become the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes I, making him a trusted companion and confidant. Judea at this time was just a small area in the Persian Empire, ranging from just beyond Jericho in the north to the Spa at En Gedi in the south. It was surrounded by enemies, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, better known as the Philistines over on the coast, also the Arabs, and especially the Samaritans. As you might guess, they all welcomed the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and wanted it to stay the way. So we are told that Nehemiah gets word from his brother Hanani about the state of affairs in Jerusalem. It wasn't good. Jerusalem is in disarray and underpopulated. Those that were there are unorganized, and the economy is almost non-existent. Morale is too low to rate. Since Nebuchadnezzar had conquered Jerusalem about 150 years prior to this, the partially destroyed walls of the city had never been fully rebuilt. In addition, the more recent incursions of the surrounding peoples had left further destruction in their wake. This greatly distresses Nehemiah. So Nehemiah showed this discontent with what was going on, and Artaxerxes picked up on it and was sympathetic to Nehemiah's concerns. God intervenes, and Artaxerxes allows him to move to Jerusalem to rebuild the wall and straighten things out. He gave him a royal commission that not only made him the governor of Judea, it included a military detachment for safe passage, letters of recommendation, and permission to get resources from the king's forest. When Nehemiah arrives, he inspects the walls of the city. As expected, he found them to be in ruins. The plight of the people wasn't much better. Most of the people in Jerusalem were poor, tired from the hard labor, hungry from the food shortage, and harassed by the neighboring nations. For the returning exiles, it was not a land flowing with milk and honey. It was, as Haggai records, "You have sown much and bring in little. You eat, but do not have enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to be put into a bag with holes." Although the temple had been rebuilt, the people still weren't obedient to God. In Nehemiah chapter 5, the people complain about hunger, debts, and taxes. Not much has changed. The economic situation, though, threatens to undermine the restoration of the nation. They were caught in a vicious cycle that was spiraling downward with no end in sight. A lot of people had to borrow money to buy food or pay their bills and royal taxes at such high interest rates that they couldn't afford to pay them back. They had to resort to giving up their land and homes as collateral, and even in some cases, they had to sell their children into slavery. Running short of food and supplies, they couldn't tend to their crops. Unable to pay their bills and taxes, they couldn't keep the crops that they did manage to grow. They couldn't get their children back because, as they told Nehemiah, it's not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. And the worst part is, the high interest was being exacted by their own people. There seemed to be no way out. That brings us to Nehemiah chapter 5 and verse 6. I'm going to read from the New English Translation. Nehemiah said in verse 6, "I was very angry when I heard their outcry, and these complaints. But instead of going through the ceiling, he took a moment, as we say, and considered the situation. Verse 7, I considered these things carefully and then registered a complaint with the wealthy and the officials. I said to them, each one of you is seizing the collateral from your own countrymen. Because of them, I called for a great public assembly. I said to them, to the extent possible, we have bought back our fellow Jews who have been sold to the Gentiles, but now you yourselves want to sell your own countrymen so that we can then buy them back? They were utterly silent and could find nothing to say. The people complained that not only were they in bad straits, but that their condition was imposed on them by their own Jewish brothers. Although the exile was over, not all could return. Some had been forced to sell themselves into slavery to the Gentiles. Nehemiah had been redeeming them as he was able. Now he finds that the same problem is arising within their own nation. A privileged minority was taking advantage of a bad situation to enrich themselves. They'd totally lost the plot. So Nehemiah asks, are we supposed to buy them back from you too? They have nothing to say. What stopped them from arguing their own interest here? Verse 9, then Nehemiah said, that thing that you are doing is wrong. Should you not conduct yourselves in the fear of our God in order to avoid the reproach of the Gentiles who are our enemies? Even I, my relatives, and my associates are lending them money and grain. But let us abandon this practice of seizing collateral. This very day, return to them their fields, their vineyards, their olive trees, and their houses, along with the interest that you're exacting from them on the money, the grain, the new wine, and the olive oil. They all replied, we will return these things, and we will no longer demand anything from them. We will do just as you say. Really? Just like that? The ending here is almost too good to be true. Kind of like a Hollywood ending. Drop in an upbeat musical number and roll credits. We're done. But even Nehemiah is skeptical. He continues, then I called the priests and made the wealthy and the officials swear to do what had been promised. I also shook out my garment and I said, in this way, may God shake out from his house and his property every person who does not carry out this matter. In this way, may he be shaken out and emptied. He says, if you don't do this thing, I pray that God will take from you everything you own, bankrupt you. All the assembly replied, so be it. And they praised the Lord, then the people did as they had promised. Now the question is, why did they do that? Why didn't they argue with Nehemiah, at least ask for better terms, maybe a 50-50 split? I mean, after all, it wasn't necessarily their fault these people got into trouble. I mean, of course, they knew that Nehemiah could have exerted his authority. He could have forced them. He was the appointed governor after all. But they did it willingly because he had moral authority. He set an example that they couldn't argue with. As if he anticipated our question, Nehemiah adds, beginning in verse 14, from the day that I was appointed governor in the land of Judea, that is from the 20th year into the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years in all, neither I nor my relatives ate the food allotted to the governor. Not unlike our economic system today, provincial governors in Persia usually assess the people in their provinces for their support. But like Paul, Nehemiah sacrificed what would normally be due him in order to serve the people and to set an example. He refused to accept the governor's expense account, which the other governors before him had used. Nehemiah continues in verse 15. But the former governors who preceded me had burdened the people and had taken food and wine from them, in addition to 40 shekels of silver. Their associates were also domineering over the people. But I did not behave in this way due to my fear of God. I gave myself to the work on this wall without even purchasing a field. All my associates were gathered there for the work. They were more focused on the work than their own lifestyle. Verse 17, there were 150 Jews and officials who dined with me routinely, in addition to those who came to us from the nations all around us. Every day, one ox, six select sheep, and some birds were prepared for me. And every 10 days, all kinds of wine in abundance. It's been estimated this would feed about 600 people, all of us, every day. Despite all this, says Nehemiah, I did not require the food allotted to the governor, for the work was demanding on this people. Nehemiah didn't take advantage of his position to enrich himself. He wasn't an opportunist. He and his men worked alongside the people on the wall. No entitlement here. He simply followed God and set an example. Nehemiah walked what he believed, what God taught. He showed that it worked. He proved to them that they could live that way too. We also influence others by the example that we set. In a world that encourages us to demand what we want, That's easy to forget. If we demand respect, then maybe the most important decision we can make this year and the coming year is to show respect. If we're complaining about a lack of appreciation, then maybe the most important decision we can make in the year ahead is to show appreciation. If we need friendship, then perhaps the greatest decision we can make in the year ahead is to be a friend. As with Nehemiah, we show others the way by our example. Another way of looking at this is in terms of this question. What would your life look like if you lived it in alignment with the demands and expectations that you place on others? What would your life look like if you lived it in alignment with the demands and expectations that you place on others? That's moral authority. The moral authority we want, of course, comes from living the Word of God. And in doing so, we accomplish four things. We show who matters, God. We show what matters, His Word. We share the struggle, the risk, and the hardship. We connect with others. And we inspire belief. When people get inside their own heads, it's hard to see that there's another way. God's way is counterintuitive to human nature. It's a way far removed from our normal human existence. People need to see people just like them who have overcome the same obstacles that they face. We inspire belief and give hope by showing, not telling. By our example, we nurture in others a higher level of inner dialogue, a habit of thought, an attitude that says, you can do this. When we walk the talk, everything we do teaches. What are we telling people is okay? By our behavior. Right now, you and I, young and old, all of us are living an opportunity that most of the world at this time doesn't share with us, but that we share with each other. It's an opportunity to build moral authority within the framework of God's word and plan for humankind that will one day help teach a new world, a new way of life. One day we can stand before the world and say, I did it. You can too. Nehemiah moved powerful people to do the right thing because of his example. His example convicted them. He demonstrated the power of moral authority to change lives, to change a nation. It's the same power that you and I are developing now to change the world.